Brethren, let me ask you a question to begin the sermon. How many of you like poems? I don't see any show of hands. How many of you hate poems? Nobody. Oh, one. Well, no, that was a joke. Okay. Now, how many of you have read poems in your life? How many of you have actually written one? At least one. All right, so quite a few. Now, those who haven't raised their hands, maybe you've written one too and you didn't recognize it to be one. How would you define a poem? In your mind, what's a poem? If you would have asked me that question some time back, I would have said, oh, everything which rhymes, it's a poem. If it doesn't rhyme, it's not a poem. Well, I was informed that's not necessarily true, because you can also have something which doesn't rhyme and still is a poem. Now, having said that, some claim that what they say is a poem, and in my mind, it's not. I mean, I listened to the quote-unquote poem, which was recited during Mr. Obama's inauguration, and to me, that was anything but a poem, and it was pretty much disjointed, too, insofar as I'm concerned. But then at the end of the inauguration, when the benediction was given by a black minister, he ended it with a poem, because it rhymed. Except it was a very controversial and offensive poem to white people, if you have listened carefully to it. And so it was a poem, but it was not a good one. So you might have good poems, and you might have bad poems, and you might have poems which rhyme, and you might have poems which don't rhyme. And so, surprisingly perhaps, in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, you will find quite a bit of poetry. Now, just to make this clear in the beginning, you won't find any rhymes. See, the Hebrews didn't write poems by rhyming. They had other mechanisms, other forms of art. And sometimes, of course, in the translation, you don't quite see it, because a translation cannot necessarily reflect the way it's done in the Hebrew. Sometimes, though, you will see it, and we will go through quite a number of examples today, and it will show, once you really put your mind on it, how many poems you can find in the Bible without perhaps ever having seen that before. Now, let me just say that I don't want to take utter credit for this, because this was something I was introduced to when I studied at Ambassador College. It was actually Mr. Mark Kaplan, who grew up in the Hebrew society, and I believe who was actually a Pharisee before he became a member of the Worldwide Church of God, who introduced us to that. Now, I have never heard anybody give a sermon on this before or subsequent. I have never given one either. But I was quite intrigued by this. I thought, this is interesting. And so I always wanted to pass it on to you. I never quite did until finally I decided I would do it. Now, I've done a lot of research myself on it, went to the Internet, and then went through passages myself. And so I hope I can just share some of my enthusiasm for this topic with you today. Now, maybe this is the most boring sermon in your mind you've ever heard. And so when you're all asleep by the end of the sermon, that's too bad, because I really like to pass on to you what I have found. Basically, I want to talk about two concepts today. Now, there are probably more in the Hebrew Bible, but there are two I'd like to bring out. The one is called acrostic. Now, you, if you're not note takers, you better start taking notes today, because without that, you're not going to be able to go through this. But the first one is acrostic. I want to spell this for you. A-C-R-O-S-T-I-C. Acrostic. A-C-R-O-S-T-I-C. Now, that's a Greek word, and it means, basically, beginning of the line. Beginning of the line. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, you have several writings in the Old Testament where you have each line or each series of lines beginning with a letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Now, you know the Hebrew alphabet has 22 letters. And so when you go with me to Psalm 119, now I have the advantage here. I have the Jewish Bible, the Tanakh, Holy Scriptures here in front of me, and they have already pointed that out for me. If I go to Psalm 119, they have placed every time when a new section of lines start with a new letter of the alphabet, they have already put the new letter next to it. So you'll find, and if you want to see this later, you come up to me and I'll show you that. You'll find, for instance, in Psalm 119, verses 1 to 8, each line starts with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. If you go to line 9 to 15, each line starts with the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And all the way through, until you reach the end of that psalm, that means that the last 8 verses of the psalm begins with the last, or the 22nd letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Now that's one way of rhyming. And so there are other examples where that is done. You might just want to judge these scriptures down when you look at them later. For instance, Psalm 34 is written exactly in the same way. Again, if I go to my Tanakh translation and I go to Psalm 34, I'll find that the way this is organized, verse 2 starts with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, verse 3 with the second, verse 4 with the third, all the way through. Another psalm which is done in this way is Psalm 37. Another interesting psalm, or I shouldn't say psalm, another interesting scripture which is written that way is Proverbs 31, verses 10 to 31. The famous proverb about the virtuous woman is written in that way. And another one is Lamentations chapters 1 to 4. All these chapters, Lamentations 1 to 4, are written in the way of acrostic poetry. Now, why is that interesting? Well, you see, for the reader, for the hearer, it was easier to remember. And God inspired those who wrote the Bible to write certain sections in that way because he felt they were mightily important. For instance, Proverbs 31, in God's mind, was extremely important for us to remember. It talks about the character of a virtuous woman. So that's obviously not anything which should be easily forgotten. Psalm 119, as you all know, talks about the law of God from beginning to end. And so as many times these scriptures were supposed to be memorized, this was done in such a way that people could more easily do it. But this is just, in a sense, an introduction, because what I really want to talk about today is the art form which is called in the Hebrew, or in the English, describing the Hebrew poetry. It's called parallelism. Parallelism. Now, in other words, you know what parallels are, right? They are the two lines, you know, parallel to each other. Parallelism. Now, as a summary statement, in the Hebrew, a rhyme is the repetition of thoughts. A rhyme in the Hebrew is a repetition of thoughts, or it might be an extension of similar thoughts. In the first line, you might have one thought, and then in the second line, that thought is being extended. Something is added to it. And that is what parallelism actually means. We speak of perfect parallelism, and that is when the number of words in each line is equal. So you have line 1 has maybe 19 words, line 2 has also 19 words. And both lines express exactly the same thing in different words. That is called perfect parallelism. Now, and then you have imperfect parallelism. That means the thoughts express exactly the same thing, but the numbers of the words are not necessarily equal. All right. We have several ways of expressing parallelism. One. That's why I said you have to have notes, because otherwise you're not going to get most of it. One. Consider yourself as being in class right now. See, if I had a billboard, I would write this all down, but it wouldn't help you much because most can read my writing anyway. One, synonymous parallelism. Synonymous. See, the word synonymous is derived from the word synonym. Synonym just means one word has the same meaning as another word. And so then synonymous parallelism means that the second line repeats the idea expressed in the first line. Now, you might wonder why this is important. We'll see in a moment. And then you have to even break it down further. The first sub-point is that you're talking about now examples which are identical. So you'd call that identical, synonymous parallelism. Identical. Now, some of you who have gone through Ambassador College or maybe Imperial Schools might have heard that. I doubt that most of the others have ever heard that, and those who have heard it probably have forgotten most of it anyway. So let's go to a few examples. Psalm 50. Now, we're talking about identical, synonymous parallelism. And again, it's very clear when we go through it, it's an easy way of remembering things for those who have heard it, so those who were told these things. Psalm 50, verse 20. Psalm 50, verse 20. And I've written it all down here in front of me, so I can even look at this more closely. It says, "You sit and speak against your brother." Next line, "You slander your own mother's son." So we see the thoughts are totally identical. Because when you sit and speak against somebody, you slander him. And you speak against your brother, and that's your own mother's son. So we have here a statement which is totally identical, expressed in two different ways. Now, let's look at another example, Psalm 24, verses 1 to 3. Psalm 24, verses 1 to 3. Psalm 24, verse 1. It says, "The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein." Again, totally identical. The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. The world is the same like the earth. And those who dwell therein, identical with all its fullness. Next verse. "For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the waters." Upon the seas equals upon the waters. Founded it, established it, same thing. Next verse. "Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord? Or who may stand in his holy place?" Hill of the Lord, holy place, same thing, identical. Okay, who may ascend, who may stand, same thing. So this is totally identical. Now I'll give you another example. Psalm 15, verse 1. Psalm 15 and verse 1. It says, "Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle, who may dwell in your holy hill." It's also totally identical, but it gives you an additional thought here. Because if you abide, then you dwell there, but you dwell there not just temporarily. And tabernacle and holy hill is the same thing in biblical terminology. It gives you an idea that when we are talking about God's tabernacle, that is where God is going to rule, on his holy hill. Psalm 2 and verse 4 is another example of, again, identical, synonymous parallelism. Psalm 2 and verse 4. Psalm 2 and verse 4. "He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision." Or as, for instance, the Tanakh Bible has it, "The Lord shall mock at them." Or the NIV says, "The Lord shall scoff at them." So again, "He who sits in the heavens," who is that? It's the Lord. So identical phraseology. "He shall laugh, but he shall not laugh because he is amused. He shall laugh in a way of knowing what's going to happen to them, because it's identified with, he shall scoff at them." So that is a kind of laughter which is defined in the next verse. But again, it's a total identical parallelism. Now, here's one interesting example for that in Job chapter 3 and verse 20. Job chapter 3 and in verse 20. It says here in Job chapter 3 and verse 20, "Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter of soul?" Now that is identical parallelism. It tells you that the two expressions got to be identical. Light is identified with life. Now you can either walk the way of life, and that is the way of light, or you walk the way of darkness, and that's the way of death. So, light is identified with life, and the one who is in misery is identified with the one who is bitter of soul. Because, you see, if you are in misery, you are bitter of soul, then you don't have necessarily the most happy emotions. And so this is a way how the Bible expresses this to identify certain terms. Notice Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 2. Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 2. Again, another example of identical parallelism, where the first line, it's totally identical with the second, insofar as the thoughts are concerned. It says, let another man praise you, and not your own mouth, a stranger, and not your own lips. Now you see, your own mouth, your own lips, that's clear, clearly identical. But now the interesting thing is here, how the other man is identified as a stranger. So it doesn't necessarily refer to a good friend. It doesn't necessarily refer to your mate or your husband or your wife, you know. It doesn't say, okay, well, let them never praise you. No, it's talking about a stranger, the one who's flattering with your mouth, who doesn't even know anything about you. See, so here we have the identification between the another man and the stranger. But now notice some interesting concepts in the book of Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 23. And here is an important principle, because unless you understand the concept of identical parallelism, you probably get the wrong impression here as what's being said. But notice in Genesis chapter 4 and in verse 23, we read about the famous word of Lamech. Now, Lamech was that guy who was the originator, if you please, of polygamy. You don't find anywhere else that anybody committed polygamy, had more than one wife, than that guy. And that guy is not necessarily portrayed in a very positive light. Because notice what it says. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 23. That's his wording here. Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. Now who is Ada and Zillah? Wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. Now here you have identical parallelism. In other words, Ada and Zillah are defined as the wives of Lamech. Some have said, oh, he had several wives. No, he had two. Only two. And these are Ada and Zillah. And they are identified as the wives of Lamech. But it goes on, next line. For I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. Now some have said, oh, he killed one man and then he killed a young man on top of it. No. That's the same one. You see, that's identical parallelism. He killed a man for wounding me, a young man for hurting me. The same statements are expressed, the same thoughts are expressed. So this guy had two wives, and he killed someone. Not a nice combination. And so then, of course, he praises himself for it on top of it. I'll give you another example in the book of Zechariah, chapter 9, which again could be misconstrued if not read carefully in light of identical parallelism. Zechariah 9:9. In Zechariah 9:9, we read, of course, a prophecy about Jesus Christ's first coming. First it says, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Again, identical parallelism, so you can see that the daughter of Zion is identical with the daughter of Jerusalem, telling you that the Bible many times talks about Jerusalem when it talks about Zion. Now, it could be a spiritual Jerusalem, too. Could be the church. And then it says, rejoice greatly, and when you do that, you shout. You shout for joy. So again, the same concepts are expressed. But now notice, dropping down, it says, lowly, so this is talking about the Messiah now, Christ, he's coming, lowly and riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey. See, in other words, he's not talking about riding on a donkey and a colt on top of it. So in other words, even for Jesus Christ, it would have been possible to do. I mean, very difficult to do. No, the donkey is defined as a colt. Some have said, oh, he's riding a donkey and somehow the colt is on top of it. This is not the way it's expressed here. It's just identical parallelism. The donkey is that colt, the foal of a donkey. All right? So again, here, this is what you can learn from using that art form of identical parallelism. Now I show you what else you can learn going to Numbers chapter 23, because there in this particular passage we have quite a number of parallelisms explained, or at least stated. Numbers 23, verse 7. Numbers 23 and verse 7. Here's a famous statement by this false prophet, Balaam, who was called to curse Israel, and God didn't allow him to. Numbers 23 and verse 7. Here is the king of Moab telling him, come, curse Jacob for me, and come, denounce Israel. Now, what does it tell you? It tells you that Jacob and Israel are identical. Now, we know that from other passages too, but some don't know that. Some who don't know the Bible don't know that Jacob is just another name for Israel. He was called Jacob, and God changed that name to Israel. And so here in this particular passage, you see the identical association. If you go down to verse 21 of the same chapter, Numbers 23 and verse 21, it's talking about God. It says, he has not observed iniquity in Jacob. He has not seen wickedness in Israel. Now, that's not talking about two different things. It's talking about exactly the same thing. God hasn't observed iniquity in Jacob, has not seen wickedness in Israel. Iniquity is identified with wickedness. Judah is equalized with Israel, or Jacob in this case, equalized with Israel. Go down to verse 23 of the same chapter, Numbers 23:23. For there is no sorcery against Jacob, nor any divination against Israel. Now, not only is Jacob identified as Israel, but we also find that in God's eyes, sorcery is equal to divination. Now, some may say, oh, well, I don't get involved in sorcery. That's nothing wrong to just try to go some guy and to let him tell me my future. No. Sorcery is divination in the eyes of God. Notice Numbers chapter 24 and verse 5. Numbers 24 and verse 5. How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel. See, again, the same thing is expressed. Tents equals dwellings, Jacob equals Israel. And so there are many more examples I could give. Maybe just look at one in Numbers 24 and verse 17. I have a few more listed here. Numbers 24 and verse 17. That's an interesting one too, talking about Christ, a prophecy. It says in the middle of this verse, a star shall come out of Jacob, a scepter shall rise out of Israel. Now, since we know this is identical parallelism, we know that the star equals the scepter. And we know that Jacob, of course, equals Israel. That's not two different things coming out of Jacob and Israel. It's the same person, identified as the star and as the scepter, Christ the morning star, the one who is ruling with the scepter, you see. All right, now we have also, I'll give you a few examples. This is still subpoint B under number one. Similar, synonymous, parallelism. First one was identical, totally identical. Now, there are examples in the Bible where the thoughts are not totally identical, but they are similar. In other words, one thought in the first line is repeated in the second line, but something else is added. That's why they are similar, not totally identical. So you have a first line, and then in the second line, you have something repeated, but then something else is added. Notice Psalm 36, verse 5. Psalm 36 and verse 5. Very nice example here for that art form. Psalm 36 and verse 5. It says, your mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the clouds. Now, in the heavens to the clouds, that's identical, but then there is a slight difference between mercy and faithfulness. Now, because you cannot say that mercy and faithfulness are identical, however, they are related. See, if you are merciful, you also got to be faithful. If you are faithful, you got to be merciful. If one of the two is missing, you have an incongruity. That's what this psalm is trying to explain. Also, Psalm 19 and verse 1 is another example. Psalm 19 and verse 1. Again, not totally identical, but similar. Psalm 19 and verse 1. It says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The heavens declare the glory of God. And the firmament, which is defined as the expanse of heaven, the firmament shows his handiwork. All right, now, of course, the heavens and the firmament, that's identical. However, the glory of God and his handiwork is not identical, but God's glory and his handiworks are related. You see, we see God's glory in his handiwork. We see God's glory in his creation. You see, when God does something, it's done in a glorious way. So here we see the connection. It is the similar synonymous parallelism which the writer here, David, has used on purpose to express that thought. All right, let's go to the second art form. The second art form is called introverted parallelism. Introverted. They also call it, and I've seen that on the internet, as chiasmus. I don't know why they call it that way. But introverted is a better designation. What does it mean? It means that the order of the thoughts is reversed. The order of the thoughts is reversed. In other words, in the first line, you have thought one, which is followed by thought two. But in the second line, you have thought two first, which is then followed by thought one. So the second line reverses the order of the thoughts in the first line. Now, unless you are really aware of this, you probably read the Bible and never see that. But notice here, Psalm 51 and verse 1. And it's also a way of helping the reader to remember things. Psalm 51, verse 1. Notice this. It says, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness." First line. Second line, Psalm 51, verse 1. "According to the multitude of your tender mercies, blot out my transgression." You see how the order is reversed. See, "Have mercy upon me, O God," equals "blot out my transgression." Because you see, if God has mercy on us, he will blot out our transgression. But then the second thought in the first line is "according to your loving kindness," and that's picked up in the second line at the beginning, "according to the multitude of your tender mercy." So that's identical in that sense. "According to your loving kindness" equals "according to the multitude of your tender mercies." And so that's why we call it introverted parallelism, because the order of the expressions of the thoughts in both lines is reversed. Give you another one in the same psalm, verse 3. Psalm 51, verse 3. "For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always before me." You see, the thought ends with "my transgressions" in the first line, it picks it up, and "my sin" in the second line. It's reversed. See, for I acknowledge, identifies, or equalizes, it's always before me. Transgressions is equalizes with my sin. Now, that also tells us something else. It tells us that when we really acknowledge our transgressions, then it's always before us. We don't acknowledge our transgressions when we try to put it behind our back, you see. That's not acknowledging it, because once you acknowledge it, once you are aware of that sin in your life, you are trying to get rid of it. And so this is also something which this very nicely explains. Another example, Psalm 30, verse 8. Psalm 30 and verse 8. I hope I haven't lost anybody yet, because it's getting more complicated as we go through. Psalm 30 and verse 8. Again, here we're talking about introverted parallelism. It says, "I cried out to you, O Lord, and to the Lord I made supplication." If it would be identical, it would say, "I cried out to you, O Lord, I made supplication to the Lord." See, but it doesn't say it this way. It's introverted. It changes the order of the thoughts. "I cried out to you, O Lord, and to the Lord I made supplication." Making supplication identified with crying out. And notice also one other, Proverb 23, which again has this same concept of introverted parallelism. Proverbs 23, verses 15 and 16. The first thought, "My son, if your heart is wise, my heart will rejoice, indeed I myself." Second thought, "Yes, my inmost being," or my kidneys, as the margin has it, "will rejoice when your lips speak right things." So here we see that the thought of "my heart," or "I will rejoice," in the second, as a second thought in the first line, is repeated as the first thought in the second line, "Yes, my inmost being will rejoice." And what is stated at the beginning of the first line, "My son, if your heart is wise," is identified at the end of the second line, because then your lips will speak right things. See, when your heart is wise, your lips will speak right things. If your heart isn't wise, your lips won't speak right things. See, that's how this comes together. You would hardly see it unless you see the concept of introverted parallelism. Now, I want to give you a third example of how the Hebrews rhymed. And that is antithetic parallelism. Now, I hope I pronounce this correctly. That's why I'm going to spell it for you. A-N-T-I-T-H-E-T-I-C. I would pronounce that antithetic. And it actually means direct opposite. Direct opposite. In other words, the second line contrasts the first line. It expresses the opposite to the first line. Until now, we have just talked about some things which are kind of identical. Now we're talking about opposites. In other words, you could say, we rhyme through opposites. We rhyme through opposites. We have that in English too. You could say, give me liberty or give me death. Now, those of you who have recently become American citizens will remember that because it's one of those questions which were asked. Who said that? Give me liberty or give me death, see? It's an opposite. Notice some examples here. I'm not going to tell you, who said that. Not to reveal whether I still remember it or not. But in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 1, you get one of those examples. Proverbs chapter 2 and verse 1. Direct opposites, if you please. It's kind of humorous, so if you look at it. In Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 1, it says, a wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is the grief of his mother. So you have the wise son opposite to the foolish son. Glad father, grievous mother. Couldn't be more of an opposite than that, see? In other words, that's how it's put together as an antithetic parallelism device. Notice in the same chapter, verse 5, Proverbs 10 and verse 5. He who gathers in the summer is a wise son. Or he who gathers in summer is a wise son. He who sleeps in harvest is a son who causes shame. So you have a wise son. A wise son doesn't cause shame, but a foolish son causes shame. How is a wise son defined? Well, the one who gathers, the one who is working hard. How is a foolish son defined? Well, the one who sleeps, doesn't gather, doesn't work hard. You see how by opposites the Hebrews rhyme. Notice in verse 4 of the same chapter, Proverbs 10 and verse 4. Kind of a similar thought here. He who has a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Again, total opposites. The slack one becomes poor, the diligent one becomes rich. In the same chapter, verse 12, Proverbs 10 and verse 12. Now, this is an interesting one because this is related to Mr. Brennan's sermonette. Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins. Notice the direct opposites. Hatred opposed to love. But you see, if you have hatred, you stir up strife. If you have love, you cover all sins. You see, so the opposite to stirring up strife is to cover all sins. Get that? The opposite to stirring up strife is to cover all sins, is what the scripture is telling us. Let me repeat this one more time. The opposite to stirring up strife is covering all sins. Let's keep that in mind. Let's remember that. That's why it's written in such a way so that we won't forget it. Notice in Proverbs 11 and verse 3 for another example. Proverbs 11 and verse 3. The integrity of the upright will guide him, but the perversity of the unfaithful will destroy them. So if you are an upright person and you have integrity, you will be guided in the right way, of course, is what it's been talking about. But if you're unfaithful and perverse, it will destroy you. Since it's the direct opposite, you know that if you are being guided, you won't be destroyed. But if you are not being guided by integrity, you will be destroyed. So again, this is expressed in such a way so that the reader can remember it. Proverbs 16, verse 9. Proverbs 16 and verse 9. That's an interesting one, too, once we understand the concept of what we're talking about, the antithetic parallelism. A man's heart plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. Now, have we ever seen it that way, that these are direct opposites? This is not saying, okay, a man's heart plans my way and then God helps me. No, you see, the man's heart plans his way. It's going the wrong way. But the Lord directs his steps. These things don't harmonize. It's a way of saying, don't trust in your own plans, but trust in the Lord, and he will direct your steps. Notice also Proverbs chapter 29 for another example, in verse 27. Proverbs 29 and verse 27. It says, an unjust man is an abomination to the righteous, and he who is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked. I mean, it couldn't have been more of an opposed statement. See, an unjust man is an abomination to the righteous. But the just man, the one who is upright in the way, is an abomination to the wicked. So in other words, the wicked hates what the righteous does. And the righteous should hate what the wicked does. Direct opposite, the way it's expressed here. Also in Psalm 37, let's go to Psalm 37 and verse 9. And when Christ says, blessed are you when they revile you and persecute you for my name's sake, then it gives you an idea here based on the scripture we just read. Because the wicked is not going to like what the righteous does. Well, the righteous shouldn't like what the wicked does either. Psalm 37 and verse 9. It says, evildoers shall be cut off or destroyed, as a margin has it. But those who wait on the Lord, they shall inherit the earth. You see, there's much more in this psalm than meets the eye first, because look what's expressed. An evildoer will be cut off. But now you have the direct opposite. One who waits on the Lord. In other words, if you are waiting on the Lord, you're not an evildoer. If you are an evildoer, you're not waiting on the Lord. You see, you want to do it your own way. And the one who is an evildoer will be cut off. The one who waits on the Lord shall inherit the earth. So in other words, he will not be destroyed. He will be ruling on this earth. Again, we see the exact opposite of this statement. Let's go to Psalm 30, going back with another book of Psalms. Psalm 30 and verse 5. Psalm 30 and verse 5. Again, unless you totally understand what we are talking about here, this antithetic parallelism, you're not going to get the whole meaning of that verse. Psalm 30 and verse 5, notice what it says. For his anger is but for a moment, his favor is for life. That was the first line. Here comes the second line. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. Now, since it's a direct opposite, what this scripture tells us, that when God is angry, that will cause us to weep. You know, obviously, when God chastises us, that's not pleasant for the moment. But God says it's just for a moment. His anger doesn't wait forever. It just endures for a night. But then he says his favor is for life. And because his favor is for life, our joy comes in the morning once the night is over and will remain for life. You see, that's what this psalm is expressing. God's anger is just for a moment, causing us to weep during the night. But his favor is for life, and the joy comes, the joy of entering the kingdom of God, that will remain forever. Notice also another interesting example in Psalm 20 and verse 8. Are you still with me? I want to be like those TV evangelists who start, you know, getting responses from the audience. sometimes humorous to see that, but I just want to make sure you're still awake here. Psalm 20 and verse 8. I think some nodding in agreement. Hopefully not because they fell asleep. All right, Psalm 20 and verse 8. Notice what this says. And of course, there you have to go a little bit back to the previous verse to see the context. Because it says in Psalm 20 and verse 8, they have bowed down. And unless you go back to the previous verse, you don't know to what they have bowed down or to what. But the previous verse talks about that they have trust in chariots and horses. Or you could say today in, you know, war machines and all these kind of things they have produced. So they have bowed down to them, the things they have done, and have fallen. Next verse. But we have risen how? Well, we have risen in prayer to God, because the previous verse talks about that we will remember the name of the Lord our God. We have risen in prayer to God and stand upright. So here again we see the difference between those who trust in their own accomplishments, and because they do, they will not have success, and those who trust in God, and they will stand upright. Again, an expression of total opposition. Now, sometimes you will even find combinations. Before I go into the next type of parallelism, I just want to give you a few examples where you have combinations of these different devices. First, I want to give you a combination of an introverted and anesthetic parallelism. To speak in English, that means not only does the second line contrast the first line, it's direct opposite, but also the order of the thoughts in the first line and in the second line is reversed. Because this is talking about both introverted and anesthetic parallelism. I want to give you an example in Psalm chapter 1 and verse 6. Psalm chapter 1 and verse 6. And frankly, it's an art form. That's why people have said that the Bible is one of the best, if not the best, literary work even ever written. And you perhaps get a little bit of a flavor when you see the way how this was done. With what kind of a tremendous technique this was done. Psalm 1 and verse 6. Notice. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. Now you have the opposite expressed, but even the order of the thoughts is different. See, for the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. Now you have the second line, the second thought of the first line repeated. So because you see, for the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. I hope you're seeing this. You know, in other words, you have the opposite explained and also the order of the thoughts are reversed. I'll give you another one in Proverbs chapter 13, verse 24. If you don't quite see it, come to me later and I'll explain it to you. Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 24. Notice what that says. Something which, if you quote that in certain countries today, like in Sweden, and would apply this, we would go to jail if you were caught. Because people don't believe anymore at all what the Bible says. But look what it says. Proverbs 13, verse 24. He who spares his rod hates his son. But, okay, now comes the opposite. He who loves him. So the opposite is not only expressed in the same way, but the order of the thoughts is reversed. So you would expect to say, he who spares his rod hates his son, but he disciplines him promptly who loves him. See, that would be a direct parallelism insofar as the opposite is concerned. But here the order is reversed too. So it says, who spares his rod hates the son, but he who loves him, opposed to hating him, disciplines him promptly or early. Now it tells you something. If you don't discipline your son early or promptly, in other words, once the opportunity arises, if you wait too long, you don't really love him. Because chances are by that time, the son has long forgotten what he did wrong. And, you know, of course, if you don't discipline him at all, you don't love him at all. What the Bible says. Take it, leave it. Fourth way of how parallelism can be done, getting more complicated as we go through, obviously, it's called synthetic parallelism. Synthetic. I spell that again. S-Y-N-T-H-E-T-I-C. S-Y-N-T-H-E-T-I-C. Synthetic. Now, It can also be referred to, if you go on the internet and do some research or some commentaries, they always sometimes call it constructive, and they call it epithetic, but I stay with synthetic, because it's derived from the noun, which means you combine separate parts or separate elements into a whole. So what this means is that thoughts are built upon each other. You have a thought in the first line, and then you have a second thought in the second line, which adds something fresh, something new to the first thought, or it may explain the first thought. And frankly, it's getting more complicated than that, because there are three different ways of doing that. The first one is complementation. In other words, the thought in the first line is complemented by the thought in the second line. Let me give you a few examples for that. Psalm 2 and verse 6. Let's go back to the book of Psalms. Psalm 2 and verse 6. So we're talking about synthetic parallelism, and now we're talking about complementation first. All right, Psalm 2 and verse 6. The first line says, "Yet I have set my king." Second line, "On my holy hill of Zion." So, you know, in the second line, it goes back to the first, but you know the first is not complete either. Something has to follow. So that's why the second line complements the thought in the first. "Yet I have set my king," second line, "on my holy mount of Zion." Notice another example in Psalm 138 and verse 4. Psalm 138 and verse 4. Same concept here. "All the kings of the earth shall praise you, O Lord." Well, when? I mean, so you have the statement, "All the kings of the earth shall praise you, O Lord." But when is it going to happen? Second line tells you, "When they hear the words of your mouth." Hearing in the sense of really understanding it. See, today they may hear the words of God's mouth and couldn't care less in praising God. But you see, once God opens the minds of the kings of the earth, see, when he rules on this earth in the person of Jesus Christ, yes, then they will praise him once they understand the words of God. The second sub-point is comparing or contrasting. See, in other words, the two thoughts are being compared with each other or contrasted with each other. Notice for that an example in Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 17. Proverbs 15 and verse 17. And by the way, once I'm done, I'm going to have you go through a test with me, and I see how many of these concepts you'll have in mind. Proverbs 15, 17. This is a nice one. You probably heard about it, but it's a way also of an art form, how to express it. "Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than," here's a comparison, "a fatted calf with hatred." In other words, it's better you have a modest meal, but it's prepared with love, and there is love during the partaking of the meal. Then you have a very elaborate meal, a beautiful, costly meal, but there's all hatred around. See, this is what this is saying. You know, of course, you can apply this to all kinds of other different principles in life. So, but this is a way of expressing it by contrast. And then the third way is you explain it. In other words, the second thought explains the first. And we have a classic example here, and Mr. Grant has given a sermonette on this, and we have that on the web, so I'm not going to spend an awful lot of time on this, but this is one way of this explanation of the synthetic parallelism. Notice Proverbs 26 and verse 4. "Do not answer a fool according to his folly." All right? Why? Here comes the explanation. "Lest you also be like him." So there are situations where you better keep your mouth shut. Because if you answer the fool according to his folly, you may be like him. They may look at you and say, "Oh, that's, you know, foolish as this guy." Now, there is another way of putting it in the next verse, Proverbs 26 and verse 5. "Answer a fool according to his folly." Well, why? See, something is missing. So the second thought explains it. "Lest he be wise in his own eyes." Sometimes you got to answer a fool according to his folly, otherwise he thinks, "Oh, well, you know, this guy's like me, and I'm wise. See, I'm wiser than he," if he doesn't say anything. And as I said, I don't want to explain the different situations. Mr. Graham did that in the sermonette. You might want to listen to that again. But you see, this is a way of the explaining synthetic parallelism concept. Now, let's go to the fifth way how to do it, and that is called climactic parallelism. They also can call it comprehensive. Some call it anaphora, or, which I like, frankly, some call it stair-like. It's like a stair. You step on the steps of a stair, climbing up. Because what that means is that the thought in the first line becomes greater and more comprehensive in the second line. See, the second line reaches a climax. That's why it's called climactic parallelism. But here's the key, how it's distinguished from others. It has to be a phrase in the second line which is repeated. In other words, the first line has a phrase, the second line repeats that phrase, but introduces new thoughts in addition. The ones we have seen before, that's not necessarily the case. But here we have in the climactic parallelism concept that a repeated phrase in the second line introduces a new thought. Let's quickly look at a few examples. Psalm 29 and verse 1. Psalm 29 and verse 1. It says, give unto the Lord, O you mighty ones. Give unto the Lord. See, give unto the Lord, that phrase is repeated. But now what are we giving? Glory and strength. So you see, the second line adds a thought to the first line, but also a phrase is repeated. Give unto the Lord, O you mighty ones. Give unto the Lord glory and strength. Another one in the same chapter in verse 3. The voice of the Lord is over the waters. The God of glory thunders. The Lord is over many waters. So again, it's a little bit added to it. It's like a stair. You know, you have some thoughts in the first line, and then in the second line, some other thoughts are added, but some others are also repeated. And then you have one in Psalm 29 and verse 8. That's actually one I like because, again, you'd have to do a little bit more research to see why that is so interesting. Psalm 29 and verse 8. Psalm 29 and verse 8. It says, the voice of the Lord shakes the wilderness. The Lord shakes the wilderness, repeated, of Kadesh. Now, why is that important? Why is Kadesh in any way important? Who is Kadesh? What's Kadesh? Well, you go back to where Kadesh is mentioned. And I just mentioned it to you now. It's in Numbers chapter 13 and in verse 26. Because Kadesh is identified as a place in the wilderness when the spies came back from spying out the promised land and brought the evil report. And it says, well, the Lord was very angry with that. And so he shakes the wilderness of Kadesh because he was angry with them, giving this wrong report and thereby discouraging the people to march into the promised land. You see, in this way of putting it, it makes it very clear why God was angry. Now, also in Psalm chapter 1 and verse 2, that's another interesting example of what we're talking about, which is climactic parallelism. But if you look at this closely, you also find that it's combined with another art form, namely the introverted parallelism. Because look what it says. But his delight is in the law of the Lord. See, and now the second thought is repeated in the first one. And in his law, he meditates day and night. Something is added. It's a stair-like concept. And here also, it's an introverted parallelism telling you it's identical, but the thoughts are reversed. Why? Because if you really have delight in the law of God, this tells us that, then you meditate in that law day and night. If you don't have delight in the law of God, you don't care. You don't think about what God says. And so here we have two art forms combined in this verse. Now, let's quickly go to the next art form, number 6. And to keep you from suspense, I have actually 7. You might have guessed that. Here's number 6, which is called emblematic parallelism. Emblematic. E-M-B-L-E-M-A-T-I-C. Emblematic. Now, here you find the word emblem in it. That's why it's called emblematic. Now, what's an emblem? Well, an emblem is a symbol, or it's a design that represents something. For instance, a dove is a symbol for peace. And so that's why you have this emblematic parallelism, because what it means is that you take a literal statement, and you have that in one line, and you contrast that with a metaphor or a simile in the second line. Now, what's a metaphor and what's a simile? Maybe you should ask for a show of hands. A metaphor, you might define that as something which is different from the literal meaning. For instance, you might say, you will eat my words. That's a metaphor. Or you might say, you have a heart of stone. That's a metaphor. Now, what's a simile? Now, a simile is comparing one thing with another thing, such as, he is as brave as a lion, or childhood is like a passing dream. All right. Now, when you look at emblematic parallelism, what you're doing is you're taking a literal statement, and you're comparing it or contrasting it, I should say, with a metaphor or a simile. And sometimes in the Hebrew, you have actually a link. A link, right? A link which makes that comparison. Notice this in Psalm 42 and in verse 1. Psalm 42 and verse 1. It says, as the deer pants, which actually means longs for, so as the deer longs for the water brooks, so pants my soul for you, O God. So you have the link. The word link is so. In other words, he's making comparison here. As the deer pants for the water brooks, so pants my soul for you, O God. There's another one where you have kind of a link in Proverbs 25 and verse 25. Proverbs 25, 25. And I leave that to you to figure out in Psalm 42, what we just read, is this now a comparison with a metaphor or a similar? Same here. One of the two it is. Proverbs 25, 25. It says, a cold water to a weary soul, so, well, they added the word is, but the word is not in the original. So the text really reads, so cold, a cold water to a weary soul, so good news from a far country. So there's still this comparison with a link. The word so is still there. The word is missing. But so you have, again, a literal statement compared with a metaphor or similar. But then there are also parallelisms which don't have a link. But they are still parallelism, emblematic ones in Proverbs 11 and verse 22. Now, they have already added that for you, but it's not in the original. See, in the original, if you look at Proverbs 11:22, it doesn't say, as a ring of gold in a swine's snoot, so is a lovely woman who lacks discretion. The word as and so are added. They're not there. So it just says in the original, a ring of gold in a swine's mouth, or whatever you want to call it, a lovely woman who lacks discretion. But it's still the comparison here, you see. One is a literal, and one is a similar, or a metaphor. Now, of course, think in terms of what I said earlier. Proverbs 31 is talking about the virtuous woman. It's written in such a way that it should be remembered, can be easily remembered. See, because what is the word we used? It was an acrostic psalm where every line starts with a letter of the alphabet. Now, here, it's just the total opposite. Here is a lovely woman who lacks discretion. She's compared with something not very flattering. All right, let's talk about now the seventh type of parallelism. And that is called palilogical. I've got to spell that for you. P-A-L-I-L-O-G-I-C-A-L. P-A-L-I-L-O-G-I-C-A-L. You know, I don't think that word actually exists. I looked it up, I tried to look it up in dictionaries and encyclopedias, could never find it anywhere. But every time I went on a website which talks about Hebrew parallelism, they use that word. So I don't know whether they made that up. But anyhow, let's use it because everybody else does. More important is what it means. It means that one or more words of the first thought are repeated as an echo in the second or third thought. as an echo. So, I don't know, maybe the Greek or the whatever word that is derived from, somehow the word echo is in there, I have no idea. But let's look at Nahum, the book of Nahum, chapter 1. And those who are listening in, or those who are here in front of me, you know, if you can show me that word defined somewhere, I'd like to see that, because I couldn't see it anybody finds, except it's always used in this context. But in the book of Nahum, chapter 1, you have a good example of this paleological parallelism. Notice what it says. God is jealous, and the Lord avenges. Now here comes the echo. The Lord avenges. See, it's again repeated. And is furious. And then it goes on, the Lord will take vengeance, same like Lord avenges, on his adversaries, and he reserves wrath for his enemies. Another example is also in Hosea chapter 6 and verse 4, looking at the first part of that verse. Hosea chapter 6. Hosea chapter 6 and verse 4. It says, O Ephraim, what shall I do to you? O Judah, what shall I do to you? See, what shall I do to you is repeated as an echo. But this is not identical parallelism because, you see, Ephraim and Judah are not identical. There's two different tribes. But it's talking about this paleological parallelism where his thought is repeated as an echo in the second thought. Here's another one in Judges chapter 5 and verse 23. Judges chapter 5 and verse 23. It says, curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord, curse its inhabitants bitterly. See, in other words, the curse concept is repeated as an echo. Because it didn't come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. So again, to the help of the Lord is repeated again in this verse. And then a very nice one, showing again this art form in Judges chapter 5 and verse 27. Judges chapter 5 and verse 27. It says, at her feet he sank, he fell, he lay still. At her feet he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell dead. So you see how the first line is repeated as an echo, at least parts of it in the second line and even the third line. And here, let's take one other final example for showing a combination of things. Again, how this is also being done in Psalm 72 and in verse 17. First, we're talking about paleological parallelism, where an echo is coming up again in the second or third or whatever line. But here we also find a synonymous parallelism on top of it. Because notice what it says in Psalm 72 and verse 17. His name shall endure forever. His name shall continue as long as the sun. And man shall be blessed in him. All nations shall call him blessed. So his name shall is kind of the echo which is repeated. And also the blessing part in the last two lines. But here we also have synonymous parallelism because forever is identified here or equalized with as long as the sun. That tells you something. Forever doesn't have to mean for all eternity. It can, depending on the context, refer to a condition which lasts as long as the elements of the condition remain. See, as long as the sun in this case is identified as forever. Once the sun is gone, and we know in the New Jerusalem, we won't have any physical sun anymore, the word forever in that particular instance might not apply anymore. So we've got to keep that in mind as well. So now I have given you now these seven ways how the Hebrew Bible uses poetry. In fact, eight ways if you take the acrostic one as, you know, another art form. And then we have seven forms of parallelism. To repeat them quickly, synonymous was number one. And then you have the subpoints which I leave out. Introverted. Antithetic. Synthetic, climactic, emblematic, and paleological. Now, if you have gotten lost, or if you would like to review all of this, I have a transcript prepared. So if you want to have a copy of this, just write me an email, I'm happy to send it to you, and I have all these scriptures I quoted today written down, so you can even compare them with what these particular art forms mean. But let me just conclude by saying this. You see, these different devices in the Old Testament were never used just for the fun of it. I mean, it's fun. I mean, I like this, you know, to see these kind of different devices and then reading the Bible some more and finding even more passages where this art form is employed. But it was never done just for the fun of it. It was done, although it's clearly an art form, not just for art's sake. It was done for the purpose of teaching, of prophesying, and of worship. You see, and the style of Hebrew poetry was ideally suited for such tasks, since important ideas were repeated in different ways, in such variety that it was art in the truest sense of the word, but it helped the listener, the reader, the hearer, to remember these things better. The poetry of the Old Testament was never tiresome, and of course, it's sometimes difficult in translations to bring it out, but it was actually a real delight to read it, to recite it. And even in translations, it can give you some keys of understanding of certain statements when we properly analyze them in the light of the Hebrew parallelism concept. So I hope I helped you a little bit today to see how beautiful, even from a literary standpoint, the Bible is written. And frankly, I'm not aware of any human work which comes even close to just even expressing the thoughts in the Bible in such a way as it was done.